morning, good afternoon, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are on a listen-only mode. After the presentation, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. To ask a question, please press star one. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. Now I will turn the meeting over to Jenny Swift. Please go ahead. Your line is open. Thank you.
Welcome, everybody, to our latest trustee teleconference, this one focusing on auto-enrollment. My name is Jenny Swift, and I'm an actuary here at Aon Hewitt, specializing in providing DC advice to trustees and companies. My role today, though, is to chair this call, this being the latest in our series of quarterly calls in which we look at topical issues in pensions. As many of you listening will know, we run these calls to supplement our regular trustee training courses to give insight into some of the topical challenges that pension scheme trustees are facing. This particular call is going to focus mainly on issues affecting trustees, but we will reflect on challenges faced by the employer as well. I'll get started straight away by introducing our speakers this morning. Joining me on the call today are Gareth Marsh and Joe Sharples.
Good morning, Jenny. Good morning, everyone. I'm Gareth Marsh, pensions consultant at Aon Hewitt. I specialise in auto-enrolment and DC matters and advise both trustees and companies in this regard.
Hello, I'm Joe Sharples. I'm an investment consultant at Aon Hewitt and I specialise in DC investments. I currently advise a number of trustees of DC schemes on all aspects of their investment strategy.
Okay, thanks both of you. Let's get straight into today's debate. So the main theme today is auto-enrolment. Clearly this is a topic which has dominated agendas over the last couple of years, but today we're going to focus in particular on learnings from the last year and what might change for those staging later on. So we're looking particularly at the challenges thrown out by the need to prepare for compliance with auto-enrolment and the experience of companies who have staged during this first year. We'll look at the regulatory changes which came into force at the beginning of this month. And then the second half of our debate today will then focus on default funds, which of course have been very much under the spotlight since the introduction of auto-enrolment. So what might be an appropriate design for the default investment strategy? But before we start, we need to acknowledge that some of today's attendees will have a greater level of knowledge and experience of auto-enrolment than others. Some of you may have already passed your staging date, and some, no doubt, have all of this to look forward to. So with this in mind, I'm going to ask Gareth to give a very brief overview of auto-enrolment for those who are less familiar.
Okay, thanks, Jenny. Right, so this preamble is probably aimed at those on the call who haven't seen any pensions media, or probably any media of any description at all over the last 18 months or so. So, in a nutshell, auto-enrolment is all about the duty falling on UK companies to automatically put their employees meeting certain age and earnings criteria into a pension scheme, meeting certain minimum standards. Alongside this, it introduces an obligation to make sure the wider workforce who fall outside of these age and earnings criteria also have access to a pension if they want it. So that's a bit of a long-winded description, but breaking it down, we're only really talking about getting people into a pension scheme, which happens all the time and sounds pretty straightforward. Unfortunately, though, like with a lot of these things, the devil's in the detail. And here, as ever, there's an incredible amount of detail, which is really the thing that's causing companies a lot of stress and strain as they look to adapt what they currently do to accommodate these new rules. So if I think about the number of interested stakeholders we have here, I can't offhand think of another piece of pension change that's needed quite so many parties to work together for it to be a success. Thinking of pensions departments, payroll departments, finance, IT functions, communications teams, recruitment, who knows, the list goes on. And while the ultimate responsibility for this lies with the employer, you and other trustees could have an important role to play, particularly if your schemes are being used as part of the solution. Help is at hand, and to complement the guidance that's out there, we had a few weeks ago the regulator issuing a quick guide specifically for trustees. Available from the website, it gives some tips and key points about your potential roles. It also sets out some issues to think about, things like impact analyses, changes to rules, record keeping requirements, communication changes that might be required. Some of them may not need much change at all, but those that are needed, I think, will need to be done in good time for your company's staging date or the go live date.
Thanks, Gareth. I think that guide is a really good place for trustees to start. Can I ask you to give us an overview of the experiences so far, but also in doing so to highlight some of the challenges that we've been working with companies and trustees to resolve?
Of course. Right, I'll start off on a positive note then, where in general, I'd say the market is learning through experience, as we'd hope. Providers, advisors, the regulator, even the DWP itself now has a better understanding of the regulations and the guidance, and ultimately how auto-enrolment's affecting companies from a practical point of view. So as well as receiving feedback from the industry, the regulator now has some first-hand experience, having sat in with some of the teams of those earlier stages and seeing the operational side of auto-enrolment. And this has probably led to some of the easements and simplifications we've seen in recent weeks from the DWP. I'll come back to those again later on, but these are generally welcome news, and we keep our fingers crossed that there'll be more of these in due course. So if I then turn to the difficulties, I think the ones we've been working through companies with have largely been situation-specific, mostly around the finer points of detail of the regs, things like making the auto-enrolment fit around what currently happens rather than the opposite way around and starting again from scratch. In effect, using the flexibility that there is out there to move or postpone the timings of some of these aspects of auto-enrolment, ultimately trying to minimise the disruption to business as usual, really. Another key aspect of timing that I thought was worth flagging, that which we continue to see, relates to the general tendency of companies to underestimate what's involved here. I think very often trustee boards are approached by their sponsors quite early on in proceedings, as a company's exploring its options. There's then probably quite a long period of sustained silence while the company deliberates, realises the scale of work involved, really, and ultimately gets started on its project. Finally, then, the staging date looms. The trustees are called back into action again to do things like amend their rules, certify their arrangements, provide data, and very often these have quite tight deadlines. So I think my advice to you on the call would be check in regularly with your employers, engage with them as best you can, understand what their plans are and how you feature within them. This will then help you plan your own schedule and avoid what could turn into a last-minute scramble and require those out-of-cycle meetings that we all dread.
It sounds like what we're saying is that those with later staging dates will benefit from the early experiences of others in terms of the learnings undergone, but at the same time, there's necessarily a significant project to be set in motion to prepare for staging, so important not to underestimate that. What specific or new challenges, Gareth, do we foresee over the coming year for those staging during 2014?
2014, probably for me, one new concern is going to be market capacity and the availability of provider resource as auto-enrolment reaches more and more companies as the year ticks on. And the way it was introduced by staggering the entry dates to auto-enrolment by the employer's size means the number of businesses that are reaching their staging dates is now higher than it's ever been, and this is only going to get bigger during 2014. So what are we seeing in reaction? Well, providers are hiring and training to try and keep up with needs and volumes, but we are already seeing a notably less hands-on approach from these, and really a shrinking desire to tailor their solutions to individual situations. Against the backdrop of an employer's needs being the same today as one who staged 12 months ago, the capacity to meet those needs, though, is shrinking. I think there's probably a lot of hope resting on the expectation that things will become more simpler in the future, and that the resource demands won't be quite so high. Until we reach this point, though, what we are seeing to combat some of this are the likes of Aon Hewitt and others entering the market, developing their own auto-enrolment solutions specifically aimed at the 2014 audience, which offer these employers a low-cost, fully supported alternative.
Okay, so perhaps we can now come on to the regulatory changes just introduced. So following the feedback on some of the difficulties caused by the intricacies or idiosyncrasies of the new rules themselves, the DWP announced only last month some changes to the regulations which were intended to ease the administration burden on employers. So will this make things simpler in practice for those staging from now onwards?
They'll help, but probably not a great deal simpler in the short term. It's a step in the right direction, and the extra flexibility will no doubt be welcomed by some. But these were really the first round of changes made by the DWP, probably the easier ones, if you like to call them that. The three main headlines, for those that didn't spot them, among a wealth of announcements of late. First one was some flexibility over the period over which pay can be measured, for assessing various aspects of auto-enrolment, in effect giving employers a bit more scope to choose a definition that's convenient to them, which is good news. Second one was some relaxation over the content of what needs to be in an opt-out notice for those individuals who want to come out of pensions. In summary there, as long as it now contains at least the statutory minimum information, that will be fine, whereas the previous guidance was a little bit more prescriptive on that. And then finally, and possibly the most welcome change that we had, although it's only one that comes in effect from 1st of April 2014, is that the window for joining a scheme under auto-enrolment will be extended from 1 month previously now to 6 weeks, and that will buy some employers some valuable extra time, no doubt. So, as I said, small steps, but they are a start. We know there are other steps already under consideration at DWP, which didn't quite make it into the October announcement, so the much-awaited whether or not people with enhanced protection or other protections can be carved out wasn't there, but it will appear in due course, we hope. But I think the most eagerly awaited proposal will be just how radically the DWP can and will simplify these rules in due course.
Yes, and here's hoping they do that. Another development in the meantime relates to a consultation just published in the last couple of weeks by the DWP, this time around a potential cap on charges within default funds in schemes used for auto-enrolment.
That's right, yeah. And Jo's going to talk a little bit more about default funds later, so I won't steal her thunder. But I think the DWP's objective here really is to offer protection to the workers whose employers may not have quite the same level of bargaining power to negotiate deals on charges as those larger employers who've gone before them, and therefore without a legislative cap of some sort, these guys could be suffering in retirement.
Okay, well, we'll come on to talk around default funds in a little while, but in the meantime, Gareth, you've shared your insights into the process to prepare for staging. What about those who've already staged? How have they fared since staging?
Okay, so what happened since staging? So I think the immediate and probably almost universal reaction for teams following staging date was to book themselves a holiday, to thank themselves for all their efforts. But on a more serious note, once all of the regulatory filings and staging date reporting is completed, auto-enrolment pretty much becomes the norm. I mean, it's a continual process, and so the first few months after staging have been spent fine-tuning this, dealing with the exceptional cases or those which hadn't been anticipated in advance. Beyond that, though, in general, what are we seeing? Opt-out levels, some variety between companies, but on the whole, very, very low indeed. The DWP reported on the first 6 months of its stages that average opt-out levels were south of 10%, and which is even lower than the market was expecting, really. And our own analysis of clients who've staged already supports that broadly. I mean, we've seen some very, very low single-digit opt-out rates, but also some higher than 10% as well. So what does all that mean? Well, probably a bit early to draw any huge conclusions, but there'll probably be a few employers out there shuffling in their seats who may not have been expecting quite such high take-up and pension costs as a result of all this. But what high take-up rates do mean is generally a positive start for auto-enrolment and giving a good platform for encouraging those members to save more for their retirement. And I think this is an area which trustees can play an important role through developing their own communications and strategy. And then finally, worthy of note from a trustee perspective, I think, is that auto-enrolment brings about potentially a significant change to the membership profile of a scheme, and even more so if these opt-out rates are low and continue to be low. So apart from the admin impact of having a larger membership now than previously, the profile does bring into focus the appropriateness of the scheme's default fund, which is a key area that's been highlighted by the regulator. So it's likely that many trustees will have reviewed this before auto-enrolment, but without the knowledge of what the new membership looks like and what its needs might be. So on that point, I'll hand over to Jo, who'll talk through how and why trustees should be looking at their default funds following their staging dates.
Great, thanks, Gareth. So in practice, there are a number of reasons why the historic default options that we've seen might not be suitable for auto-enrolment, and I'll come back in a moment to an important point about the change that Gareth made about the changes to the membership profile post-staging and how this can drive strategy. And before I come on to that, I'd like to make a few comments, firstly, about the change composition of default funds over time. One of the key things that we've observed is that many of the historic default options in place on existing defined contribution schemes may not be suitable for the auto-enrolment environment. Typically, a default structure in the past has invested in passive global equities for the vast majority of the members' working lifetime. Then, at a point which is usually somewhere between 5 and 10 years before retirement, assets start to be mechanically switched from equities and into bonds and cash. Now, this strategy does have a number of benefits, including its very simple design, the associated fees are generally low, and also have low governance requirements. However, it also has some quite significant drawbacks, particularly when you think about it from a member outcome basis. And the main disadvantage is that this type of approach does maintain a very high level of risk within the default strategy until really quite close to retirement. And I think this is best illustrated by way of an example. So if we take it, so for an example scheme, if we start the switching process 5 years before retirement, then if we look at a member aged 60 who's looking to retire at 65, then their investments would be wholly invested in equities at that point. And this potentially exposes that member to a lot of risk, market risk. And actually, this risk could be really quite significant because their fund value is likely to be at or very close to its peak. And importantly, members at that point in their working lifetime also have very little time left to correct any adverse experience, either through making more contributions or perhaps changing their retirement plans, for example, delaying retirement.
So actually what we're saying is the traditional equity-based lifestyle strategy offers material risk just at the point when members are at their most vulnerable due to both their fund size and also their proximity to retirement. So Jo, do you see funds moving away from equities entirely?
No, we're certainly not saying that equity investment is inappropriate. In fact, we see it as a key part of any default strategy, but we much prefer to focus its use during the growth period for the earlier part of a member's working lifetime. And as a result, we're seeing the default strategies being used for auto-enrolment move away from this historical default approach that I described earlier. And actually, such an approach is very unlikely to meet the requirements that have been set out by the DWP. So when we have take a look at new DC schemes, then they're typically adopting a much lower risk lifestyle approach, and then we're seeing more and more existing DC schemes move away from using such an approach.
So the regulator issued detailed revised guidance for DC trustees, which we expect to see finalised later this month. And trustees need to be comfortable how they comply with that guidance or otherwise explain why they've chosen not to. So I think trustees are going to need a lot of help here because it's the first time the regulator has properly articulated what it expects of trustees. So they're now going to need to consider their own position and what they do differently ongoing. So perhaps we can start by giving some clarity around how trustees should set their default strategy. Coming back to the point about the membership and how it might change after staging, the new guidance from the regulator naturally puts heavy focus on how trustees should design and monitor investment strategy. And one of the things it expects of trustees in going into any such review process is that they should have a good understanding of the membership. Can you just talk a little bit about the value of this and how trustees would go about getting that better understanding?
Yes. So when we're setting a lifestyle strategy, we think it's really important to understand the membership first. And only by doing this to begin with can you actually determine the right investment strategy for those members. So how do you go about doing this? It can actually start off with some quite simple analysis. For example, looking at the age and salary profile of your membership or the age and fund value profile. You can then use this data to segment your membership into different groups, where each group has similar characteristics. So, for example, you might have a group of relatively young members with low average salaries or a group of members with higher average salaries. The harder part is actually piecing all this together and working out what this means in terms of the differing risk and return characteristics of those different groups. Once you've divided the membership into a number of distinct groups, and it certainly doesn't have to be a lot of groups, typically we would see somewhere between 3 to 5 is being used, then you can determine a strategy that best meets the particular needs of that group. So, for example, you might want to have a strategy that offers a lower risk and return profile for a particular group, and conversely, you might have another group where you feel that a higher risk profile is more suited to their characteristics. And we've done this exercise very successfully with a number of our clients.
But presumably it may be that one default strategy remains appropriate, so I think we're not necessarily saying that all schemes need more than one lifestyle or default going forward. But I think the key advantage of this approach, in other words, of modelling the impact of a strategy on different groups of members, is that that then gives us comfort that the default we put in place really is fit for purpose. And we can then use that clarity around the different subpopulations of members that we've got in our scheme to drive a targeted approach to communications, so helping members with the choices they have to make by enabling them to translate their own circumstances to the investment choices available, and to give clarity around the potential impact of those options on their own retirement outcomes.
Yes, I think that's right. So you don't necessarily have to have segmented strategy, but you may want to. Another example of where a segmented approach to strategy may potentially be valuable is around the benefits that that strategy is targeting at retirement. So, for example, members in a particular group may be more likely to take an annuity at retirement, in which case investing in a fund which aims to match changing annuity prices would be suitable. Alternatively, you may have another group of members where you feel a drawdown type strategy is better, and again, you might want to offer an investment strategy that focuses more on drawdown. And I think understanding this up front is really important to make sure that your members have the right options available to them.
And is this member analysis also relevant to the range of self-select or freestyle fund ranges that trustees offer? In other words, for those members who don't want to go into the default fund?
Yes. The membership analysis can also be extremely helpful in determining the freestyle fund choices to offer. In particular, understanding how your members are making choices and also where they are investing can help you to focus your governance budget in the right areas. It can also help you to identify and then deal with any issues early on. So, for example, if you have a lot of members investing in cash, this could be a perfectly good reason for that, but it could signal an early problem. Another good example is if you have older members who are invested wholly in equities. Again, there could be a very valid reason for them doing that, or they may have decided to make some freestyle fund choices previously and simply forgotten that they need to start thinking about lifestyling as they get closer to retirement.
Okay, so what about the timing of the review though? So auto-enrolment introduces a new segment of the workforce to pension saving. It potentially changes the characteristics of the membership population in the pension scheme, and we need to reflect this in strategy. However, it might not be possible to second-guess this new profile up front.
Yes, I agree. And in many cases, we're seeing trustees or the employer use an existing default fund as long as it's broadly fit for purpose on an interim basis. Then, once they've passed their staging date and the new auto-enrolment members are in place, have been in place for a period of time, then they're actually going back and revisiting this area. And actually, this is ideal because by analysing the membership post auto-enrolment, this enables the data available to be a lot more useful. You'll have information on people's age and salary profile, and also know what sort of investment choices they're making. And it's worth noting that there may well be features of the existing default strategy that can be improved based on the understanding from this data. And this is really important because ultimately it will lead to better member outcomes and a better member experience. So some examples of areas you might want to look at would include whether the risk and reward profile within the default strategy is acceptable for the membership over their working lifetime, whether the strategy is targeting the right mix of benefits at retirement, so for example, the mix of annuity and cash, or whether it's a drawdown one would be more appropriate, and also whether most members are taking inflation-linked or fixed annuities at retirement. Now, in some cases, it will be too early. You won't have the data to be able to take a view on that, but you'll need to have an assumption built into your default strategy. Mm-hmm. And understanding these factors help us to determine the objectives for the default. We can then think about how we best structure that default in order to achieve those examples. So this would generally focus on areas like looking at, for example, whether the growth phase is appropriately structured, and how it goes about reducing risk as members near retirement, whether you actually have the right underlying funds in place, so are they performing as you expect and are they delivering the outcomes that you want them to, and if you're using some sort of pre-retirement fund to match target annuity purchase, then actually how good a job is that fund doing at matching annuity prices?
Okay, so we're clear we need to review the default. The regulator expects us to find an appropriate default strategy which meets the needs of the membership. We've talked a bit about the components of the default funds, But Joe, at high level, can you walk us through what's your view on an appropriate structure for a default fund to manage members' risks as the position changes over time?
Yes, of course. So I start off with thinking about the different phases over a typical member's working lifetime and the requirements in each of those phases. And generally speaking, you can split that into three broad areas. The first is a growth phase, the second is a phase that focuses more on capital protection, and the third is a risk reduction phase. And I'll pick up each in turn. So turning to the growth phase first, this would commence when an individual starts work and might run up to, say, age 50. And so it actually could last for somewhere between 20 to 30 years, and is definitely the longest phase of the three. During that period, individuals will be contributing to their pension, and so it's really important from an investment perspective to put that money to good work. And a key characteristic of members during that period is that they have a long time horizon to retirement, and so typically they are able to take a bit more risk. And this tends to lead us to investment strategies that focus on growth, and so we would generally see quite a high proportion invested in equities during that period. Next phase is more around capital protection, and this might run from, say, 15 to 20 years before retirement. Generally, at a point where an individual may start to be thinking more about retirement, they may have a pension goal in mind, whether that's a particular date at which they want to retire or how much income they want. And at this point, they start to become a lot more sensitive to market volatility and particularly drops in their fund value. And critically, this is at a point where their pension pot is really quite big, and so in monetary terms the impact of a market fall is that much bigger than it has been previously. Also, they have a lot less time to put it right, whether that's through increasing contributions or changing their retirement plans. So picking up all these points and linking it into the investment strategy, it leads us towards less risky investment strategies, but crucially those strategies still need some growth because they've still potentially got 15 to 20 years to go before retirement. So generally, you would have more diversified investment strategies, you might have bond-focused investment strategies, or those which have a greater focus on capital preservation. And then the final phase is a risk reduction phase, and generally this might start, say, 5 years before retirement, and the key here is to protect the expected pension that's going to be delivered. So from an investment point of view, you're coming out of growth assets completely, you're moving into lower risk bonds and cash, and you're really looking at matching the ultimate benefits that are going to be bought. So in summary, an ideal default would have three key phases. You have your growth phase, you have your phase which is more about capital protection, and then finally you move into your risk reduction phase. And each of these will look to have a risk and return profile that's consistent with the member needs in that period. And overall, you'll combine them in such a way as to target the risk and return requirements of your members.
So in summary, the world of DC is changing very rapidly. DC provisions become much more important to all of us as the predominant pensions offer on the table from our employers and also those of whom we serve in our roles. And as such, getting the design of the default strategy is crucial to achieving good outcomes in the post-auto-enrolment world. We need to understand the needs of our members and think about the structure of the default on this basis to best manage the risk that our members face. And of course, we need to think very carefully about the building we use to then deliver that strategy. So, Joe, what about the market? What new solutions and innovations are we seeing in response to these new challenges?
Yes, now we expect to see a lot of innovation in the market over the next 3 to 5 years with new ideas and new products being introduced. And this very much reflects the increasing size of the DC marketplace, but also the much greater emphasis being placed on DC investment by employers, employees, and providers alike. And it's probably worth me giving you a few examples of some of the areas where we're seeing development at the moment. So the first one is around the pre-retirement funds being used to match annuity purchase. And over the last 12 to 18 months, we've seen a number of new products launched in the marketplace, and we've also seen existing funds relaunched with different strategies. And one of the challenges that these funds have faced in the past is that a lot of them have invested in index bond strategies. And if you look at the cash flow profile of the bond index, it tends to be very lumpy with the regular coupon payments and then the repayment of capital coming in big lumps. When you compare that with the cash flow profile of a typical annuity, you can see there's a significant mismatch. Now, to some extent, that risk has been hidden over the last few years because both bond prices and annuity prices have been going up. But looking forward, and when we look at the new funds, a lot of the new funds are very much focused on matching the cash flow profile of the assets with those expected from an annuity. So we should start to see a lot less risk in this area. And this is really important, as I noted earlier, because the risk reduction phase is all about reducing risk relative to the benefits that you want to buy. Another area where we're seeing innovation, and this is perhaps a bit early days, is around the creation of income drawdown focused strategies. Now, this is fairly commonplace in the US, where they have a lot of people doing income drawdown, but relatively new in the UK market. And we are starting to see a number of products come to the marketplace that are more income focused, that are looking at this area specifically. But I think this is an area where we see a lot of growth, particularly as we see more people with larger DC pots coming up to retirement and demanding this type of strategy. Now, on the growth side, there's an ongoing debate around daily versus non-daily dealing funds. And to date, the DC investment industry has been very heavily focused around daily dealing funds. And there's a number of reasons for this. But one of the potential drawbacks is that investors going into daily dealing funds will tend to miss out on the illiquidity premium that you can obtain through locking up your money for a period of time. And actually, when you think about a typical DC member, there is generally no reason why they actually need that daily liquidity, given that they'll be invested in their DC pot for 30 to 40 years. Now, having said that, there are a number of practical challenges around introducing non-daily dealt funds into the marketplace, and there are various providers and industry groups sort of looking at these. Again, I think this is a sort of watch this space area, and I expect that we'll see quite a lot of innovation over the coming years and months.
So I think the advice that we can offer trustees on the back of that is don't just set and forget your DC strategy. The markets and products available do change, and it's worth keeping up to date and introducing changes when it's right for your scheme. So thank you both very much. I think between you, we've had a really comprehensive discussion around what's coming for those trustees on the call who've not yet reached their staging date, but also for those who have and have perhaps not yet reviewed their default strategy. Just before we stop and invite questions, I'll just summarise the main points highlighted today. Which for me are, firstly, don't underestimate the work to do in preparation for staging. It's a very in-depth process, particularly from the employer perspective, and generally there's less to do from a trustee perspective than there is for the employer. But setting aside for a moment considerations around investment design, as a minimum, you're going to need to review your rules, you're most likely going to need to amend them, and also amend scheme communications and administrative processes. So there's the possibility of having a fair amount to do in a short space of time, and clearly you're going to need to be linked in with your employer and their own plans, so I think we would just say early discussions around those are particularly important. I think the second point to note is that the new regulatory changes around auto-enrolment in reality have limited impact. There are some welcome simplifications on specific technical areas that don't fundamentally change the compliance requirements from staging or indeed the work to prepare for compliance from staging. And finally, I think we've made a case to say today that you will need to review your default fund. It's something actually you need to do regularly and will want to do regularly ongoing, because naturally things develop over time, whether that's your own member profile, whether it's member behaviours, new investment thinking coming to the fore, or new solutions coming to the market. But it's really important in the context of auto-enrolment to ensure it remains fit for purpose with your potentially changed membership as a result. So with that, can I propose, please, operator, that we move to any questions?
Of course, thank you. We will now begin the question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1. Please unmute your phone and record your name clearly when prompted. Thank you. One moment, please, while we wait for the first question. As a reminder, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 now. Thank you. Thank you. The first question comes from the line of Steve Jones. Please go ahead.
Hi there. I thought it was a very interesting presentation. You talked about understanding your membership profile, and you said you'd got some clients where you'd put it, where you'd segmented the membership down and offered different defaults for different parts of the membership. I'd be quite interested in an example. I mean, obviously, if you've got a scheme that's on top of an old legacy defined benefit scheme, I can see a case there where you'd certainly offer a different default. But I'd be interested in anything outside that where you've done that, please.
Yeah, so one of the schemes in question where we've done this, we did the analysis, and the segmentation really focused more around the type of benefits that we were targeting at retirement. And so it was looking at the different groups and trying to assess whether they were more likely to take annuity or a mixture of annuity and cash, or potentially using drawdown as well. I mean, I think in this particular example, they had some existing, some of the members had some existing DB benefits, and so we ended up with two groups, one without the DB benefits, where the DC was their entire pension provision from this employer, and that we would typically, we ended up targeting a mix of annuity and cash at retirement. And then for the ones where they had the DB benefit, we went for a slightly higher risk strategy as well, but we targeted a much greater allocation to cash because most of the members were actually doing that at retirement.
But in terms of pure DC, so ignore the DB piece for a minute, in terms of a pure DC plan with no DB legacy, what examples can you think of where you would segment the membership down and put different defaults in?
Yeah, and that's a very good question. What we have found is that it can be quite a challenge to actually implement different defaults for different groups of members. So generally, most trustees and most employers are wanting to have a single default. So in some cases, you might do the analysis and perhaps have identified a number of strategies, and then you aim to one that works best for the majority of members. But in that case, you would also have some optional lifestyle strategies, or additional lifestyle strategies, I should say, that sit around that. So, for example...
I thought you said you'd put some in where there were different defaults, that's all, for different populations. So apologies if I misunderstood that.
We've put them in. We generally tended to have a single default because that's the easiest to understand, but then have the option to have additional lifestyles which people can effectively self-select.
And we've got examples of where we've actually guided, the trustees have taken a decision to heavily guide the various subpopulations towards those different lifestyles. So to segment their population, decide what's the right strategy for them, not go quite as far as implementing it as the default, but then target communication around that to guide members towards those. And actually, in those cases, we've seen some really good take-up rates to suggest that people have essentially mapped themselves to where we would have wanted them to go anyway. So we do recognise the fact that trustees are uncomfortable with going as far as implementing different defaults. I think personally it's likely that there will be more going in that direction, but there aren't too many doing that at the moment. Does that help answer your question?
Yeah, I think so. I am unconvinced that analysing the membership particularly drives the default you put in when you've not got a DB legacy aspect to it. I think analysing the membership is more around determining there aren't any special features that should drive the default, I think, is my own view. But I'm just interested in yours. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. The next question comes from Tim Rawlinson. Please go ahead.
Good morning. It's a very simple question. Are the documents that we've had presented to us today available to be sent by email?
So there will be a transcript online. I don't know whether the operator can answer that question about whether they're made available via email. I'm sure the answer is probably yes. Operator, are you able to answer that?
Sorry, can you repeat that for me, please?
The question was, will the documents that have been presented today be available by email?
Not from this.
Or online.
There's an online transcript. Yes, there is.
Thank you.
No problem.
Thank you. At this time, we have no further questions.
Okay, well, thank you very much, everybody. With that, I will close the call. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for participating in today's conference call. You may now disconnect. Thank you.